to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to Shoot the Defence Live. I'm your host, Stel, and joining me tonight are two special guests, and one is coming later. First of all the way from round the corner is Mike Pieri. How are you doing, Mike?
Good evening, Stel. How are you? I'm good.
Mate, how are you?
Yes. Tired. Been a long day.
I can imagine you being a teacher and all that.
Yeah, well, you know, life.
And my second guest tonight is none other than Rodri Giggs. Mate, welcome back to the show. Great to have you back.
Carl, Ethan, you okay?
Yeah, sweet as a nut, mate. It's good to see your face again, because usually we do it over the phone and we don't see...
This is the first time, so yeah, so hopefully it goes well.
Yeah, so far so good. I haven't had any complaints yet, so let's see. Right, gents, yeah. let's start with our Premier League review, shall we? And it was Champions 0... Champions elect minus Thiago Costa 3 at the King Power Stadium. Now, Chelsea ran riot, putting in a performance that silenced many who felt that the club would be affected by the rift between Costa and Conte. Now, Mike, Alonso was the unlikely hero in this game with 2 goals. Now, has the former Sunderland and Bolton man turned into the complete fullback under Conte?
Joe, I forgot he played for Sunderland. I remember he played for Bolton until, you know, you pose a question out. I actually liken Alonso to Aspilicueta. And, you know, in that he just gets on with it. And he's, you know, he's been just efficient and quietly just been, you know, performing week in, week out. But he's been very, very crucial to Conte since he switched to his 3-4-3 formation back in September. I think he's just added some sort of tactical nous to his physical and technical attributes. And this can only be down to Conte and his training and coaching methods. He can play, you know, he's a footballer. He can play and he's shown he can also score too. And it's this versatility which Chelsea and Conte are going to need, because if Conte ever needs to go back to a 4-4-2, then Alonso can easily slip from centre back, as it were, third centre back, and into a full back role.
Absolutely. And apparently, Conte's initial problem with Costa was his fitness. Now, there's another twist in the tales. Costa has allegedly been made an offer he can't refuse. The irony, by a Chinese club. Now, Rodri, let's say, for argument's sake, Costa does a U-turn and decides to stick it out for the rest of the season. Can we regard Chelsea's favourites to the title, mate?
Yeah, most definitely, yeah. I'd still have them favourites even if he went. They didn't miss him Saturday and they're looking really, really strong. And even if they did go, I'm sure they would get someone in before the window shut anyway, so... No, I still think they're looking strong. With teams behind them now dropping points, it's only better for them, really.
Absolutely. And both North London clubs, you know, they registered 4-0 wins at the weekend. Spurs trounced West Brom, while Arsenal made light work of Swansea. Now, James, I'm going to pose this question to both of you. This time last year, Giroud was hammered for his poor goal-scoring record. I think he went 12 games without scoring. But Wenger stood by him and he's repaid the faith by scoring some vital goals this season. Where does he sit in your list of best Premier League strikers?
I think he's an alternative to the established way that Arsenal play. And yes, he's, you know, scoring goals in a rich vein of form. And I think he's a good footballer. He's a good player. But he's not the calibre of striker that will turn potential title winners into title winners. He's not like the missing link. And in some ways, Giroud does epitomise this this often quoted fragile mentality that Arsenal are perennially accused of. I mean, his ridiculous celebrations after equalising against Bournemouth, you know, just says it all. For someone of his age and also the length of time he's been at the club, he doesn't really strike me as a senior player who can galvanise his teammates and get them together and be a leader. And that, unfortunately, is the problem for Arsenal. He's just not a top-class centre-forward. I mean, I'd place Costa, Aguero, Ibrahimovic, Lukaku, definitely Kane, Sturridge if he's fit. I'd even put Defoe as a better centre-forward than him.
Wow. Rodri, what do you reckon?
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree, mate. He's a squad player. He's not one of them players that you can pin your hat on. He's not going to get 30 goals, 25 goals a season. He'll pit him with 10, 15 possibly. But like you say, he's not reliable enough to go for a full season. And the way Arsenal play, he's like you say, he's way down the list of one of the top strikers of the Premier League anyway.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Well, Harry Kane is another striker in form at the moment. I mean, who do you think, hypothetically speaking, would score more goals if they switch club?
Ooh, tough one, huh? You're going first, Mike, there.
I was going to leave it to you. I'm quite happy to go first. I mean, I just think he just has a knack. You know, he is a goal scorer. And let's not forget, he's playing in a team that are not used to winning trophies. Yes, they're winning lots of games, but he's performing and scoring. And he's an integral part of a young and, let's be honest, an exciting team. I read something today that in his first 100 Premier League games, he has got the same scoring record as Thierry Henry, and that's high praise, surely. I mean, even at the weekend, they were debating whether Harry Kane is on target to beat Alan Shearer's Premier League record of 260 goals. I mean, he's on 62, but he's only 23 years old. Now, for me, Giroud relies on those around him to provide him the opportunities, whereas I think Kane can actually produce goals himself. He can start on the left, cut in, and we've seen him curl those shots into the corner. And I think he's just got more to his game than Giroud. Personally, if Kane was in the current Arsenal side with Ozil, with Sanchez providing opportunities, he'd probably be on 20 plus goals already.
Worried?
Yeah, Giroud. Kane for me is like a bit of a Van Persie. He can be a 9, he can be a 10, he can go out to the left, he can go out to the right. He's a totally different player than Giroud. Giroud's just a hold up player, a long ball specialist. He's not as mobile as Harry Kane. No, Giroud would probably get not even double figures if he played for Tottenham. Harry Kane, he's the real deal. He can do everything. If he was in Arsenal, I'd say he'd score probably 20 to 30 goals easily. He'll probably do that with Tottenham. Mm-hmm. And I hope he breaks out his record for the record.
Well, you never know. You never know. The way that these international games are coming thick and fast, you know, they've expanded the World Cup now, and you just never know. You just never know.
Possibly. Well, if he comes to United, he will.
There you go. Fantastic. Well, Everton gave Man City a hiding Guardiola will never, ever forget. Now, Rodri, much has been made about Bravo's goalkeeping ability or inability, however you want to see it, but there's only so much blame you can put on the bloke. I mean, City were absolutely shocking from back to front, weren't they?
They were shocking, but like you say, in a title-winning side, a goalkeeper usually saves you 15 to 18 points. I can't remember, since he's joined the club, I can't remember him making one save or just one thing that he can say that he's done well in. Yeah, he can play well with his football, but that's not what his job is. His job is to keep goals out of the goal. And it's just, obviously his teammates are not helping him. Otamendi's a liability. They've got Zabaleta, Yaya Toure. They can't get out of the pitch. So they're going to struggle, especially against a Ross Barkley and that young Tom Davis, who I thought was excellent. So it was up against it. But Bravo, no, he's not for me. Not for me at all. But he's going to keep on persisting with him. And, you know, that's down to the manager. It's not down to the keeper if he keeps on making mistakes. The manager keeps on playing him, so he keeps on making his mistakes. You know, he's going to have to be accountable. Get Mr. Guardiola.
Do you think he's going to recall Joe Hart and give him a chance? Do you think he's actually going to, you know, bite his tongue and, you know, swallow his pride and say, right, I've made the mistake. We need you in this team.
On my personal opinion, I think it's not about Joe Hart's goalkeeping abilities. It's about his mentality on the training pitch, in the dressing room, maybe a bit of a leader and influence other players. Maybe that's been identified before he's even got to the Manchester City, and that's why he's got rid of him. So I don't think Joe Hart will come back. I think he'll go somewhere else for another keeper.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of Yaya Toure? Apparently, he's turned down a 430 grand a week deal in China because he doesn't need the money and he likes playing in England.
Well, if you believe that, then you believe anything. But You never know about these stories anymore. Is it even true that you'd think if it was true, he'd be on his way, because you know it's a lot of money. He's come to the end of his career, and I don't think City's in his heart. Do you?
Well, they didn't give him a birthday cake, and he threw a spot. So you know, what would you rather have, a birthday cake or 130 grand in the world at your feet? But you know, I'm not a professional footballer, so I can't really speak on that. Mike, it's been a strange debut season for Ronald Koeman, mate. I mean, his squad hasn't been crippled by unnecessary sales like at Southampton, and he's been given a substantial amount of money to spend on players.
A bit of an enigma. I think Everton's season seems to, I don't know, just mirror their recent history where they flatter to deceive. I mean, they were brilliant against City, and I do love the fact that Koeman gave two youngsters their chance, and and they repaid him with goals. Mm-hmm. Everton always produced quality young players, and maybe Davies and Lookman are another pair to be aware of. I mean, the Premier League is very, very competitive, and there are a lot of top teams. I mean, we say as United fans that we've done so well recently, but we're still sixth, you know. Yeah. And if I look at Everton, I mean, being where they are, isn't that par for the course? Isn't that really where their level is, given that those above them have got so much more resources, so much, you know, bigger squads and better squads? How much more do we expect from Koeman and his team?
Well, how much do the fans expect? I mean, they brought in Bellassi, they brought in Schneiderlin. You'd think that with Lukaku getting the goals, that they would aim for a higher position than sixth. I mean, look, fair enough, the competition is very, very high at the moment. But at the same time, they are a big club. I guess the fans feel that they should be challenging for a top four place, even though they've only ended there once, and that was under David Moyes. I don't know. Maybe the levels of expectancy have increased since Ronald Koeman has come in. I mean, he did work wonders at Southampton.
Hmm. No, I agree. I mean, maybe we need to give him that season to bed in, see the squad, bring his own players, give him a couple of windows, and then judge him at the end of next season.
That's a fair point. Fair point indeed. Well, gents, but poor results before Christmas led to doubt creeping in. But the 1-1 draw against United seems to have given them a new lease of life. Is it Everton, by the way? Sunday's result proves they're not to be taken lightly.
Not for me.
Both of you.
You can take this one, Rodri.
Sorry, say again, Stiles. Miles away then. Say again, sorry.
Well, I'm just saying that, you know, when Everton drew against United, it kind of gave a new lease of life, kind of galvanised them. You know, the heads dropped, but as I said, Leighton Baines' last minute equaliser kind of, you know, gave him a kick up the backside. And Sunday's result just shows that, you know, no one can really, you know, I said, take them lightly.
Well, like what Mike touched on before, you've got to give someone like Koeman a bit of time. He's a class act, and you can obviously see that now. He's getting his team together. Ross Barkley's coming on as well. Lukaku's getting goals. Even Williams is settling down now, and obviously Coleman and Baines are like Rose and Walker after Tottenham. They're the key to what they're doing, the key to how they play, the key to what they're doing, and they're playing well.
What impressed me most about Koeman's system on Sunday was the fact that he played a 5-3-2, and he wasn't afraid to mix things up. You know, he had Seamus Coleman, right wing back, bombing forward. But then he had Holgate on the right side of a three, and he tracked Sterling every time he made those runs. Tracked him every time, because obviously he knew that with Coleman pushing forward, Sterling would exploit that position. Now, why do you guys think that Guardiola didn't, again, mix things up or make any changes? He just seemed to be very happy with the system that he had, even when they were a goal down.
He's just wedded to what he believes in. He will change things during a game, but it will change him to what he believes in rather than to what he necessarily sees. I've said it before, and you know that for me, pragmatic managers are the more successful ones, because they can adapt and change their environment, to their league, to the players they've got, to the teams they have, to how they have to handle the media. Whereas dogmatic managers with a philosophy, who've only got one idea of playing and one idea of how the game should be played, tend to be found out to a certain extent. And I think that's what's happening here. I mean, Pep, for example, I mean, even when he was at Barcelona and Bayern Munich, there was always these, he always had sort of defensive problems. Not, I won't say problems as such, you know, they won trophies, but he was never a coach who could set up his team in a defensive way. You know, he was always able to rely on a front six or seven that will always score far more goals than they would concede.
That's a fair point. That's a very, very fair point. The thing is, Kevin De Bruyne, as much of a fantastic player as he is, should City fans be concerned that he hasn't scored in the league since the 16th of September?
I think you've got to play him in the middle. You're playing him out wide and you're playing players like Yaya Toure and Zabaleta. You've got to have people who can get about the pitch these days. And Yaya Toure and Zabaleta, they're not going to get about the pitch. Yeah, they'll make be decent on the ball and have a bit of quality on the ball, but that's not what you need in the Premier League. And they just got outrun. Even though City were comfortable and with better side, more possession, Everton had one shot in 45 minutes and won the look. Then they had a second shot and then they 2-0 up. Then the City up against it. So they weren't that far off. But like I say, he's not good. He didn't change it because they were doing quite well and Everton had two shots and he scored two goals and then obviously they're chasing the game and then that's when the two other goals come in. But
and there was that penalty appeal in the first half with Sterling, which could have been given. Any other referee may have given it.
Well, that was a difficult one because you had to look at that two or three times in the replay before you can decide, well, yeah, it's a definite penalty. So that was a difficult one. But yeah, it was a penalty. And things aren't going his way. And you know, there's going to be a big clear out there in the summer, definitely.
Absolutely. Now, Mike Schneiderlin has come in to no doubt be Barry's long-term replacement. But what of Lukaku, mate? I mean, should they be casting their net wide to find another goal scorer? I mean, there won't be a lack of suitors in the summer, will there?
No, I mean, Lukaku, in lots of respects, is not dissimilar to Harry Kane in that he has an excellent scoring record. But whereas Kane is surrounded by far more talent and ability, enabling him to score quite freely from far more opportunities that are created, Lukaku has sometimes to fend for himself. I think that if I was to compare Lukaku and Kane, I'd say that Lukaku's first touch sometimes needs working. But like Kane, he is a goal scorer and his record does speak for itself. And definitely, I mean, if he was to go on the market, you know, plenty, you know, I would say that every team in the top four, top six would want to buy him.
Mm, fair point. What do you reckon, Rodri? Rodri?
I think he's muted.
Is he?
Yeah, look, he's got the mute sign on.
Oh, sorry, I've got the mute on.
There we go.
I pressed the mute then, sorry.
All right.
No, what Mike touched on, if you remember rightly, in international... You got me now?
Yeah.
If you remember, in an international, Lukaku with his first touch was terrible. So in international football, you don't get that kind of that time. But obviously, that's something he does need to work on. But he's a goal scorer. He'll get you at least 20 goals a season, at least. And if things need to work, and he's still young as well.
Question for you both, actually. While we're on the subject of Romelu Lukaku, why do you think a lot of the big clubs haven't really made an offer for him? I know he played for Chelsea, but then he had that move to West Brom and then ended up at Everton. Why do you think, you know, your Juventuses, your Real Madrids, all these big clubs haven't taken a punt on him?
I think it's what we said there. I think, you know, if you're talking about at the top level, at the highest level, and, you know, Rodri said that international football, that first touch is vital. I mean, if you look at someone like Aguero, his first touch, it's bang, it's there, and he's away straight away. He can create something immediately. Whereas Lukaku, you know, he uses his physicality to create something. And even if his first touch is not great, his speed and his ability on the ball in terms of his bulk and his strength can get him somewhere. But whereas at the top level with the top teams and, you know, to win a Champions League or to be a title-winning team, you need to be... Perfect's not the right word, but that first touch has to be spot on every time.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, look, before we discuss the Manchester United-Liverpool game, because we're waiting for Matt Sapolsky to come on, let's go on to our other than news section. We'll do things, we'll mix up a bit today. Now, Hull has reportedly, Hull has reported its first iceberg sighting as the FA considers retrospective bans for diving. Satan warns Hull could actually freeze over. Now, gents, it's about time. the FA use common sense on something, but will this open a can of worms? I mean, is there a risk that divers will become some sort of martyrs? I can just see football experts on social media say things like taking a ban for the sake of the team. What is your take on the whole thing?
I think the...
For me... Go on, mate.
I think, for me, the first thing, and, you know, I would say, is who's going to judge whether it's a dive or not? I mean, it's probably easy to identify blatant dives, but there are occasions, you know, and Rodri's played the game at a higher level than we have, when footballers pull their leg away because they see a flying tackle coming in. It's not a dive, but evasive action to avoid themselves being chopped. But a referee will give it as a dive. And I think who will judge it is really important for me.
Yeah, you've got two kind of things there. If you go back to the one on the weekend, I think it was the Chinese lad or the Korean lad for Swansea who left his leg in, like, went over, if you remember right. And there was one a couple of weeks ago with Saha on the edge of the box where he's going at pace and he's come across him and he's only touched him. But because he's going at pace, for me, it was a penalty. But then the other pro said that it wasn't a penalty. So it's a grey area where it's just going to be very, very hard work to determine. Was it a dive or wasn't it a dive? Who determines that? Referees, ex-players? It's just a difficult situation. So it's rather than me to sort that out.
Well, that was that incident with Paul Pogba and Mark Noble, wasn't it? Where Pogba, even though he was booked for diving, he was actually trying to get out of the way and he ended up falling flat on his face and he got booked for diving.
Hmm. Yeah, and you just look at the player as well, Mark Noble. He's not going to go down. He's not going to be a diver anyway. That could go against him as well. Certain players have reputations and it's a penalty and they don't give it because they've got reputations of diving. So it works against them. Sometimes it goes with them and sometimes it works against them. So it's just a difficult area to sort out because the cheats in it. There's no way about it. There's cheats.
Absolutely.
But if you're on that side and your teammate gets touched in the air and you don't go down, you're going to be screaming him in the change room, why didn't you go down?
Exactly.
So it's difficult. It's difficult.
Double-edged sword.
Yeah.
And so Louis van Gaal has decided to hang up whatever his managers hang up, clipboard in his case, probably. Now, let's be honest, the way United went about his sacking was nothing short of a disgrace. But aside from a dreadful November, December in 2015, Van Gaal can hold his head up high after guiding United to the first FA Cup success in 12 years. And let's not forget that Ajax team. Gents, as loopy as Louis is, no one can question his CV. I mean, there are managers out there who, even nowadays, who haven't achieved even a crumb of what he has, yet they're lauded as revolutionaries. He was a great manager in his day, wasn't he?
Yeah, his CV says it all. He's Ajax, Barcelona, and obviously Manchester United, Netherlands, he did well with them. He was a great manager and he always remembered for the Ajax side. It was an unbelievable side, that. So, yeah, he was a great manager and hope he enjoyed his retirement.
What's your favourite moment about LVG, Rodri?
Oh, when he took that dive. When he took the dive. That was the best bit.
Mike,
my favourite bit. I think
just in general.
Well, I think I mean one of the favourite things. I think his press conferences were good fun. To be honest, they're good fun. And when he called out, was it that Sun reporter called him the fat man? I think that was quite funny. He didn't find it funny, but anyway, I thought it was funny. But as you said, I mean the Ajax team is his legacy, and he won trophies wherever he's been. His faith in youth as well is also a credit to him. I mean, he was never afraid to use young players. But he does remind me of Guardiola in a way, in that he, you know, just stubbornly clung on to this philosophy thing. When, especially in the Premier League, it was blindingly obvious that I don't think the Premier League is that sophisticated. And I just think that he was the right manager at the wrong time. I would even say he was the right manager for the right club, but at the wrong time. However, I think his fundamentals are correct. You know, take care of the football and let the ball do the work. So, you know, his positives and what he gave to the game far outweigh any negatives.
Mm-hmm. And that Ajax team was absolutely phenomenal, wasn't it? I think the average age was like 21, 22. And I think Clarence Seedorf played in every single position that year that they won the treble, every position apart from in goal. Absolutely fantastic.
Well, that's total football, isn't it?
Mm. That's right.
That's how the culture in Holland, they play them in all different positions. They're all comfortable in different areas. That's how the way they play, and that's how the way they culture as a kid.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you unearthed a lot of talent, as we mentioned, you know, your Finidis, your Overmars. You know, even at United, he helped bring through the likes of Lingard, gave Rashford his opportunity. Look, I was one of the people that slayed him a lot last season because obviously, you know, results weren't great. His tactics weren't fantastic. You know, I think, was it, we went half a season without scoring a goal in the first half until we played Swansea at home. A lot of the football was diabolical, but let's be fair to the guy. As I said, he won the FA Cup, came fourth in his first season, and on top of that, United's defence was pretty solid last season.
They were solid, but at Manchester United, over the years, you know, you've got to be, it was very regimented, and at Manchester United, you've got to be able to take risks now and again, and he wasn't a risk taker, and, you know, that's why we had so many draws and so many boring games, because the players were regimented, they didn't take risks. This is your job, stick to your job, don't go in certain areas. And it was very, like I say, regimented and very boring at times. Mm-hmm. So it was, it's a difficult one for me. If he was, but it's like Mike said, he's the right manager, but the wrong time.
Fair point. And so, Stefan Jovetic, remember him? He scored the winner for Sevilla, who ended Real Madrid's unbeaten streak with a 2-1 win. Now, Mike, many felt Sevilla would crumble once Unai Emery left for Paris, but Sampaoli has done absolute wonders. He's picked up where Emery left off, taken to another level domestically and also in Europe. Now, do you think they've replaced Atletico as the gooseberry in the Real Barca title tug of war?
I mean, it's a stunning result, wasn't it? I mean, it's also worth noting that this is a team who are used to winning trophies. I mean, under Emery, did they win, was it 3 Europa Leagues in a row?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And an incredible achievement. So there are players there. And as a club, they know what it takes to win. And Sampaoli, you know, went with 4 at the back against Real, which is different to his usual 3. Clearly intent on making it difficult for Real's fullbacks to push on. Now, if they are going to, if they are going to try to win La Liga or go to win La Liga, they are going to have to play close to 100, at their 100% for the rest of the season. Whereas for teams like Barcelona and Real Madrid, to their depth of quality and the players they've got, they can get away with just 75%, 80% in some games and still win those games. And that's the difference, I fear. I mean, also to make it more difficult for them is that I fancy them to beat Leicester in the Champions League. So fixture congestion could be a problem for them. But at least it makes La Liga slightly more unpredictable.
That's right. That's right. And what's impressed me most about Sampaoli is the fact that he's relied quite a bit on loan signings. You know, he's got Vieto from Atletico Madrid. He's just brought in Jovetic on loan. And Samir Nasri, he's basically rejuvenating these footballers who, let's be honest, even the likes of Nzonzi, obscurity, you know, and he's getting the best out of these players. And once again, Sampaoli again reminds me of like your Harry Redknapps, like your Mourinho's. You know, they can get the best, Ferguson's, they can get the best out of these footballers who, you know, as I said, weren't really doing anything at their clubs, but he's given them a new lease of life. And as you can tell, second in the league, then the Champions League. And I actually think they're going to run Real Madrid close this season.
I mean, you saw the reaction when they won at the end, you know, that camaraderie, that togetherness. And that's what, as you said, coaches like Sampaoli will do to the teams. You know, they'll galvanise them, they'll get them together. There is that togetherness, and that team spirit's very, very important in a team sport.
And don't forget, this is the coach that won 2 consecutive Copa Americas with Chile, with a Bravo in goal.
Yeah, so in spite of Bravo, he won.
In spite, yeah. Brilliant. Well, let's go on to the game again with Manchester United and Liverpool. I think Matt is about to join us in a few minutes. So let's see what we've got here. Right, so Ibrahimovic, we know that he saved the day for Manchester United, scoring a controversial goal in the 1-0 draw against Liverpool. Now, gents, obviously we're all United fans here, but let's get our backsides firmly off the fence. Was it a fair result or did someone deserve all 3 points?
I thought it was a fair result in the end. no one, I didn't think anyone deserved to win or anyone really deserved to lose. It wasn't a great game. You know, United putting the pressure on late on, as you'd expect. But I don't know what Klopp's argument is with the old long ball, and I thought it was a fair result.
Because he was saying something about United hit too many. I mean, I didn't read the quote, to be honest. I saw it on social media, people talking about Jurgen Klopp complaining about long balls and how Liverpool played more long balls than United. I mean, there's too much being made about it. I mean, let's be honest. A lot of managers tend to say things in the heat of the moment. We all do. But have his comments been blown out of proportion?
Yeah. Obviously, it's just Manchester United, isn't it? So I think it was after the game, a bit of heated. He was still a bit irate from Mourinho. So he wears his hat on the sleeve, Klopp, doesn't he? But I don't know what his problem was. You know, they switched up. They got the goal. It wasn't working. They were defending deep. They were allowing him no space in midfield. So they were just bypassing midfield. And it was working for Lainey, Ibrahimovic. They couldn't handle him in the end. And they got the goal. And they could have got the second in the end. But, you know, it was a fair result in the end. I don't know what his problem is. You know, if it's not working, if you go to plan B.
Well, exactly. I was about to ask you, what did Klopp expect United to do, to be fair? Because, as you said, they're chasing the game. You got two big guys up top with Fellaini and Ibrahimovic. Obviously, on the ground, it wasn't working for United. Out wide, it wasn't working for United. And the middle wasn't working. So, what else is there to do? I don't understand. Mike, can you shed some light on this?
I mean, I'll just go back to your earlier question. Was it a fair result? I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not quite sure I understood the analysis of the game I saw and the analysis that I heard and read. I mean, maybe I'm too biased, but just on chances created, I think United at least deserved a draw. But had Pogba and Mkhitaryan scored their two great opportunities, the chances that they created, then would anyone have been, you know, would have said they didn't deserve it? I mean, United created goal-scoring opportunities. Liverpool created moments. And there's a difference there, huge difference. Because to turn a moment into an opportunity, you've got to make the right decision. And obviously, in United, in those two moments with Pogba and Mkhitaryan, the final pass made it. Whereas in moments, they're squandered opportunities. So, you know, had Pogba and Mkhitaryan scored, who's to say United didn't deserve it? But with regard to the long ball, well, what Klopp was saying, long ball, I mean, in the match, there wasn't much difference between the long balls that were played by either team. And also read you know, someone posted on social media, and I looked into it myself, that Liverpool have actually played more long passes and more long balls than United throughout the season. So, you know, pot calling the kettle black, I'm not sure. Ultimately, when you're behind, you know, as Rodri said, you know, there is a greater need to get the ball forward quickly. You know, the balls were not aimless. You know, there was a method. You needed to get it up quickly. And, well, you know, if Klopp's so wedded to his dogma and his philosophy, well, what I would say is, how beautiful was it then to have five players surrounding one player when he gets the ball? Because that's exactly what they did every time Martial got the ball. Now, I know they had the young fullback, the right back there, but as soon as Martial got the ball, you know, just surrounded by five players, was that beautiful football? I mean, personally, I'm relieved United got the draw. Disappointed we didn't win, because I thought United were the better team. You know, grateful for Zlatan's goal, but for me, I think Mourinho sort of swayed too much on sentiment when he brought Rooney on. And yeah, I mean, if it takes Liverpool to run, I think something like 10 miles more than United to get a draw, and we're unhappy about it, I think it says more about us than Liverpool.
That's right.
He answered his own question in his interview after the game. He said he was comfortable for 70, 75 minutes, and the long balls and the balls are bouncing in our box and it causes problems. So what does he want him to do? Stay for 90 minutes so you're nice and comfortable? Or do you want to mix it up and cause problems, which he did, and we got the goal and really could have pushed on for the second.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, let's go back to when Liverpool ran City close to the title a few years ago when they had Suarez and Daniel Sturridge up top. I've got this firm belief that had Liverpool not got rid of Andy Carroll, they probably would have gone on to win the title, because he would have been their plan B. He would have been that big man in the box, lumping the balls up to him, knocking them down. becoming very physical in the box and giving Suarez and Sturridge another outlet. And just as we're talking about Liverpool, Matt Topolsky, welcome to Shoot the Defence again, mate. How you doing?
Hey, guys. How's everybody doing?
Hi, Matt.
We're very good, mate. We're very good, mate. How you doing?
I'm great. I'm great. I just finished up my work day. So I know it's later for you all over there.
Hey, listen, it's a pleasure to have you on, buddy. It's a pleasure to have you on. Listen, we're just talking about Jurgen Klopp and his comments about United making those long balls. What do you make of them?
You know, I thought it was a good idea for them to do it simply because we didn't have Matip in the back, and I thought that was one of the biggest reasons why we conceded the goal in the game was a lack of height. I'm a fan of what Clavan's been able to do in reserve, but one of the reasons why we brought Joel Matip into the team in the first place is because we lacked height in defense. It's one of the reasons why we got killed on set pieces last year. So getting a long ball in, getting behind the defense, and then, of course, getting a ball into the box for somebody to put a head on it is a great way to score a goal against Liverpool. And anyone who's watched us this season or last knows that we're going to concede if you get in there enough times.
We were tweeting each other during the game or before the game, and you said, well, you know, with Lovren in the team, there's always a chance. What is so bad about this football? Because he had a pretty decent spell at Southampton.
You know, Lovren to me sort of strikes me in the same way that Mignolet does. He's sort of an idiot savant in a way. You either get a really great performance out of him or you get a boneheaded performance. I remember two seasons ago, Lovren at one point, I forget exactly who we were playing, but he dribbled the ball out to about the halfway line and was trying to step over defenders. And I'm thinking to myself, what in the hell are you doing? So he'll have those moments, and I don't know if it's because he's trying to prove that he's a better player than what's been talked about on Twitter. And then there'll be other moments where, as I stated before, when we chatted about it the other day during the game, the first 25 to 30 minutes, Lovren was pretty shaky. A couple of times he conceded balls in dangerous areas, and then he pulled it together, and I thought he had a tremendous next two quarters of the game. So it's one of those things where I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's a confidence issue with him, if there's more pressure because he's playing at Liverpool and he feels like he needs to perform above and beyond what his actual capabilities are. But that's always been the thing with Dejan Lovren is you never know what you're going to get. It's either a great performance defensively or it's one that concedes goals and ultimately costs us points.
Mm. Lovren is what we like to call a bruise out here. You know, he's not afraid to give a player a few kicks. And that's probably why I presume Klopp asked him to man mark Pogba on set pieces, just to, you know, pull his shirt, give him a few kicks here and there, you know, tell him that he's there, so to speak. But Rodri, Pogba conceded the penalty, and it was a needless handball, wasn't it? I mean, he was rightly criticised for his stupidity. Now, this is a learning curve, isn't it? I mean, I doubt we'll see him do anything like that again anytime soon, or could be wrong, he'll probably do it again against Spoke.
Well, I think you've seen it through the previous two or three corners before where they've got the block on him, so he's paranoid, so he's given enough space where he can see his man, but he's not watching the ball. So he's all over the place, really. You'd think he'd be decent in defending, seeing as he's been in Italy for 4 or 5 years, because they love defending. So possibly he should be doing better. He should be tighter, and he should be touch tight. There should be no excuses, but like I say, they knocked him off his game for the first two or three corners. They were putting a block on him, so he gave himself enough space, and then obviously he's lost flight of the ball, and he's given away the penalty.
Mm. Well, look, Fellaini was absolutely hammered for conceding the penalty against Everton, but Pogba seems to have got away with it lightly in comparison. I've ripped Fellaini to pieces on social media, as you guys know, but when he's on his game, he's so difficult to contain. I mean, he actually had a hand in two goals against Liverpool, if you think about it, this season and last.
If you play Fellaini in the right areas, he will cause anyone problems. It's when you're playing him as a holding midfielder, he's not a Michael Carrick, he's not a Bastian Schweinsteiger, he's not a Herrera. He's a person who needs to get the ball into him at the edge of the box or in the last third, and he'll cause problems all day long. I don't know why. There must obviously be a witch on with Fellaini, with the booing and all the people that slag him off on social media. I don't see that myself. I think he's a good, honest pro. He's not a Manchester United player, but that's not his problem. They bought him. He's doing a job for us. And you know, he pulled us out of the mire on Sunday.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Now, Matt, I've always said that Liverpool's movement and pace in the final third were always going to be a threat to United, but I believe there's one thing preventing Liverpool from taking the title, and that's a reliable goal scorer. And by reliable, I mean someone who can stay fit for three quarters of the season, bag 20 to 25 goals. Now, Sturridge should really be that man, mate, but he's too inconsistent and, surprise, surprise, unreliable. What do you reckon?
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem. The other problem is that Daniel Sturridge, as you've seen this season, hasn't gotten much game time. And part of the biggest reason why is because he doesn't fit into Jurgen Klopp's system. Jurgen Klopp asks a lot more of his number nines than other managers do. He wants a number nine who's going to press, who's going to win a ball in dangerous areas and create chances not only for himself but for the players around him, namely Adam Lallana, Mane, and Coutinho. And we saw in the first half of the season that Firmino was very effective at doing it. As a matter of fact, for the first month or two of the Premier League season, I don't think there would be a better attacking player in the league than Roberto Firmino, which is interesting because when Liverpool signed him, I heard a lot of these so-called experts talking about what a bust it was. I can tell you right now, there are a ton of Premier League teams that would love to have him in their side when he's on his day. So, that's something that Jurgen Klopp believes Daniel Sturridge cannot do. Now, where I will agree with you is, yeah, we do need a proven goal scorer getting forward. It was one of the things that was frustrating to me in that game is that we didn't bring Daniel Sturridge on at some point because I'm thinking to myself, we're not asking this man to play 90 minutes, and we need a goal here. And if only we had a proven goal scorer on our bench. Oh, wait, we do. And he didn't come in. So that's one of the frustrating things. Far be it for me to be critical of Jurgen Klopp, because trust me, I wake up every day as a Liverpool supporter and I'm very, very happy that he's our manager. But at the same time, the January transfer window has been open now for 17 days. We've made no moves. We went and got Mane in the summer transfer window. I was extremely happy with that, but we knew that we were going to miss him during the African Cup of Nations for a month. So what was our alternative going to be? We need somebody up front who can bag goals for us at least 20 a season if we're going to win the title. And we never truly replaced that goal-scoring threat when we sold Luis Suarez. Never happened.
I agree. And him playing Origi, I mean, as much as a good player Origi is, he's not a 26 goal striker. He's someone that you bring off the bench when you're chasing a game or, you know, you got, you know, so an injury to, say, someone like Daniel Sturridge.
He's a pacey player who can press for us. He doesn't press intelligently in the way that Firmino does, but he can press. He can play the wing. You can play him as a center forward if you want to. But I agree with you. I mean, he's not the proven article. And I think a lot of it comes down to his relationship with Klopp. I think Klopp likes him. I think Klopp sees a lot of potential and promise in him. And there's more of, at least I'm constantly reminded by some of my other friends who are supporters who are more glass half full than I am. About this, that it's more of a long-term plan for Liverpool. That, well, it's not about winning the league this year. It's about finishing top four. But I look at the table and I say, but it's right for us. I mean, eventually Chelsea's going to drop points and it's available and it's there for us. So if it's there for us and we have a shot, why not take it and go out and try and win a title?
Fair enough. Well, much was made about Matip's exclusion from the lineup. Apparently Liverpool failed to get clearance from FIFA about whether or not he can play during the African Cup of Nations, even though he said he wasn't going to play for the Cameroon ever again. Mike and I were absolutely bewildered on Twitter the other day that what is going on. We weren't complaining, don't get me wrong, but do you know what's going on, Matt? Because if Klopp doesn't know, how will Barcelona know?
Oh, this takes me back to the Sacco issue earlier this year where supposedly he had tested positive for a banned substance of some kind of fat burner. And then later on that was dropped. And I think there was more to the story than that. It just got to the point where I became disinterested because of all the other shenanigans going on regarding Sacco and his relationship with Klopp. But I mean, we all know the history of FIFA and the corruption and weird stuff that goes on there. So, you know, I can only speculate on what's happening or what the reason was for all this to begin with. But it would be nice if the club had a definitive answer other than, you know, we're looking into it or whatever the case may be regarding Matip. Now, I don't even know whether he'll be available tomorrow for this matchup against Plymouth Argyle or not. So I, to be honest, I really don't have an answer, and I don't know any more than you gentlemen do. But it would be nice to get him back into the team because the club is paying him for his services, and it's a shame that the player is being held hostage like this, and so is the club, basically in limbo, waiting for some sort of a decision. It's pretty bizarre.
Well, Rodri, I'm going to put this to you, mate, because during the Euros, you were very vociferous about, you know, players not choosing to play for their national teams or whatnot. He's basically said he doesn't want to play for Cameroon. There's no real reason. No one really knows why. I don't know if it's about money or whatever, but this is Africa Cup of Nations. Cameroon are in a competition with another 15 teams, however many teams it is. What would you say about a player that doesn't want to play for their national team, especially in a competition where it's quite prestigious, let's be honest, for that continent anyway?
I don't know why you wouldn't want to play for you. I mean, you don't know the reasons. Obviously, there might be something behind the scenes, but I shouldn't see why you'd want to not play for your country. It's, like I said, we've been for this before. It baffles me how people don't want to play for the country. But if he doesn't want to play, he doesn't want to play. But, you know, rules are rules. If they've called him, obviously Liverpool are more worried about losing points, so they've got to stick by the rules. But it's just a grey, sticky area, isn't it?
Mike, what do you think will happen? Do you think they'll ban him? Do you think FIFA will, you know, get involved as they normally do when it comes to things like this? And also, why is international football so important to FIFA?
Well, it's their bread and butter. Without international football, you won't have the World Cup. Without the World Cup, you won't have the TV deals, and therefore FIFA ceases to be what it needs, what it thinks it needs to be. You know, a cash-making cow. I mean, I said it on the show a couple of weeks ago when I talked about how club football to many is the predominant, you know, football at the moment, more so than international football. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure Matip hasn't played for his country since 2015.
That's right.
I don't want to play. Now, this FIFA rule on the African Cup of Nations would only kick in if he got picked for his country. Now, if he's already stated he doesn't want to play for Cameroon and he gets picked, how's that Matip's fault? How's that Liverpool's fault? I mean, who's paying his wages? Liverpool pays wages at the end of the day. It's not the Cameroon FA who pays wages. Yes, they would like him to play, but you know, the guy's chosen not to play for his country for whatever reason. And it doesn't matter what the reason is. You know, I'm with Roger. I think he should play for his country if he get picked, but he's chosen not to. Why are Liverpool then the ones who, you know, feel the negative consequences of this? So at the end of the day, as I said, they bought him, they pay his wages. You know, maybe FIFA or Cameroon or the African Cup of Nations or whoever needs to, put something on Matip rather than Liverpool, because Liverpool who are the ones who have been the negative, you know, got the negative consequences from this.
My one thing I would say to add to that too is that, you know, Liverpool had to have known this was coming. I mean, much like how they knew that Mane was going to be involved in the course of the month of January, they had to have known this was an issue when they signed Matip from the beginning. So what work did they do on their end to sort of verify his eligibility throughout this entire process? I mean, it seems like they haven't done anything, because anytime a member of the press asks them a question about it, they don't really seem to have a solid answer, and it seems to change. So part of this too is on the club in terms of them keeping their house in order, which is why I thought from the moment that Jurgen Klopp was hired, they should have had a director of football, which is something that he had at Borussia Dortmund, and it's something that he should have had at Liverpool from day one. So, I mean, it's just issues like this that I think also fall back on the club as well. They've hurt themselves by putting themselves in a situation where both they signed a player, their own was hanging out there, and then they didn't have a solid answer as to how they were going to handle the situation once it became a problem in January.
I think with Mane, though, I mean, I think the club and maybe Klopp, I think a lot of people are surprised how important and influential he's been. So even though they knew he was going to go to the African Cup of Nations, I didn't think Klopp even himself, believed that he would be such an important player and thought that, you know, come January, we'll be able to make do without him. You know, that would be my feeling. But with Matip, I agree with you. I mean, the regulations are there, but maybe they did feel, look, the guy doesn't want to play for you. even if you pick him, he doesn't want to play for you. Therefore, he's going to be okay. So maybe it's a case of let's see rather than we know. And as we, you know, as you correctly said, they clearly don't know.
I think it's quite funny how these days there have been so many admin mistakes at football clubs. You saw with, you know, Real Madrid and David De Gea, the fax machine got jammed or whatever excuse they had, and Liverpool forgetting to write a letter to the Cameroon FA. What? I don't even know what to say about these things anymore. You'd think that these multi-million, billion-pound companies would have someone, you know, pay an apprentice to come and fill out your forms or whatnot. They'll get a better job done than the people that seem to apparently know what they're doing. It's pathetic.
Not telling the anti-doping agencies where you're going to be training.
You want to go into that now?
No, not really.
Brilliant. Well, guys, look, that wraps up our show. Matt, Rodri, Mike, thank you ever so much for agreeing to come on the show. It's been a fantastic first hangout for us, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Okay. Yeah, brilliant. Cheers, gents. Enjoyed it.
Brilliant. Matt, give everyone your Twitter handle because and tell us what you do, or tell our listeners what you do, because obviously this is your debut live. Tell our listeners what you're up to.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. Sorry I couldn't come on a little bit sooner, but I'd definitely be happy to be back anytime. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can follow me at Matt Topolsky on Twitter. I think my Instagram's TP Topolsky, so it's just me doing stuff with nice filters. I host a wrestling show here in the States. It's Booker T's Reality of Wrestling. So WWE Hall of Famer Booker T has a television show that I host each week here in Houston. And you can check that out at realityofwrestling.com. And I have some other projects and podcasts and all kinds of stuff. So just check out my Twitter and you'll find out all about it.
Excellent. Rodri, tell everyone your Twitter handle, mate, because you're very active and you make us laugh.
My Twitter handle is Rod James Giggs and currently coaching at FC United.
Excellent. Joe, I just noticed you're wearing a Wales sweatshirt.
Yep.
What's the way?
There you go.
See, I just noticed. Wales. Excellent. Pieri?
Yes, I'm at Del Pieri.
Excellent. And you can follow us at Shoot the Defence. So until next time, take care.